So, of course, we'd like to thank our speakers tonight, Rabbi Neuberger, Mr. Harari, for coming and giving of their time. It's late, and yet they're enthusiastic to be here with all of us and to inspire us and to guide us and lead us into this major transition in life, leaving kind of the cocoon of yeshiva and YU and moving on to the workplace. I just wanted to frame kind of the evening, tell a story of a friend of mine and his first experience, really, with moving into the workplace. He learned in Eretz Yisrael for a couple of years, like many people do before coming to YU. He was in YU for several years. He took off a year after he graduated to learn a little more. And then he got a placement in an accounting firm, one of the larger ones, and thank God he had a job. So as they at least used to do back then anyways, they would send you off to a different state for training. So he goes off with the whole new group of recruits. He's newly hired to this training. What does he know? He's like a sheltered guy from yeshiva to yeshiva. But he figures this is a very professional organization, a big name, everyone's heard of it. So it's going to be done professionally and appropriately. So he gets there, and of course, you know, they put them in this hotel, and they start these trainings, and almost everybody's just fresh out of college, all these young guys, and he couldn't believe what was going on in the rooms and what was happening at nights. It was just crazy. But at least he was able to kind of wall himself off into his own little Dalet Amos and be to himself. But it was just the partying and the drinking and whatever. Fine. But towards the end of the entire training session, now the company itself sponsored a night out. It wasn't people doing it on their own. It's the company-sponsored party night out. And so they announced at one of the trainings, anyone wants to get a bus into the city, we'll arrange it, let us know, and we'll put it together. You'll come, we'll all go out to the city to have a good time. So he was torn. Should I go? Should I not go? What's it going to look like? I'm not going to go. That's what he decided. He decided he's not going to go. Well, before they get onto the bus, they gather all the different training groups together. There must have been 80 to 100 people in this room. And they're gathering them all together just to tell them a little about the night. And the leader of his group gets up and says, well, we're all going out to get on the buses now. I'd just like to point out one person who doesn't want to come with us. And he points to my friend and calls him out by name. He's like mortified. So like he's turning beet red. The person just, so how come you don't want to go? She says to him. He's like, okay, I guess I'll go. I'm going. Fine. He goes. He gets on the bus. And I mean, it was terrible. And they take off and they go to the city and these crazy things. And here he thought the company itself is professional, so it's going to be okay. People do their crazy things. Here's the company itself. The woman in charge of him is kind of putting him on the spot, embarrassing in front of everyone, and put him in this very uncomfortable situation. Well, afterwards, it gets a little bit worse, and then I'll end off with for our speakers. So after the night, he somehow manages the night. This is his first experience. He said this has been the hardest experience he's had ever. It is worth, thank God he's doing well. But again, it was a rude awakening for him. So he gets back, after they wrap up the whole session, they're ready to head back home. The head of his group calls him over and says, I just want you to know I failed you for the training. He said, you failed me for the training? He said, yeah, I just want you to know I failed you for the training. He's like, okay, you know, I understand. I don't take that personally. She goes, no, you should. You should take that personally. He was flabbergasted and dumbfounded. So I don't know if this is an aberration. Maybe our speakers will tell us it is. But again, this was a big company, a reputable company. And this is what people face, these kind of challenges, these kind of situations. And how do we manage them? How do we deal with them? What's the best tactics? What's the strategies? How do we keep ourselves feeling like that we're being the people that we want to be while still making the livings we want to make? So with that, I turn to our speakers and to help guide us through this.
So it's truly an honor to be here, to be next to the Rav. I'm truly humbled. So whatever I say, it makes no sense. It's because of me, and if it makes any sense, it's because of the Rav. So if you have any questions, just direct it that way. I just want to open up with a thought that really touched me. I happen to have a practice of asking people for advice a lot. Random people. I think, and I told my students today, I think that if you ask anyone for advice, they love giving advice. People don't love giving a lot of money, but they love giving a lot of advice. Sometimes it's not worth it, but it's fun. And one time, I'll never forget, it was the beginning of my career, and I was struggling with this, you know, what the issues we're going to talk about today. from and holding on, hashkafa versus career advancement. I was really having a little bit of a tough time, and a good friend of mine saw, we were talking once on Shabbos, he goes, you have to meet my mentor. I said, okay. So he hooks me up with this guy. I go meet him for lunch. I go up to his office, and I walk in, and it struck me that his mentor wasn't even Jewish. I was like, okay, here we go. Because behind him, he had graduated from a Jesuit college. He was a Christian guy. So I'm like, I don't know where this is going. But I said to him, I'm going, yeah, someone's always here. I was having this struggle, that struggle. So he looks at me, I'll never forget. He looks at me and goes, your problem, son, is that you can't find the threshold. I said, is that like Christian talk for something that I should know about? Is that like a term, like in Hebrew, that I don't know? He goes, you can't find your threshold. I said, what do you mean? He goes, you Jews love thresholds. I said, we like decorating thresholds? What are you talking about? He goes, every one of your homes, don't you put God's name on your threshold? I said, yeah. So he goes, why do you do that? I'm like, am I being tested now by a Christian guy about hashkafas and mezuzahs? So he goes, I always learned that the reason why you put on the threshold is because there's two types of people in the world. He goes, there's some people that are people that understand the outside world. You got to be a certain person on the outside. You can't walk around in your pajamas outside. You talk a certain way. You act a certain way. You have to be a certain person on the outside. Because then there's some people that understand what's going on the inside world. You talk differently on the inside world. If you bring the outside world to the inside world, you're not going to have an inside world. In your house, it's different. You dress differently. You speak differently. You say things differently. He goes, but a great person understands that life needs to be great both on the outside and both on the inside. And knowing how to walk the threshold and saying, this is outside, these are my outside problems, now I'm inside. I don't bring my problems to my house. I don't bring my stress to my wife. And this is what's going on in my family life right now. I don't bring that to my job. The ability to balance both, to be at the threshold, is what makes people great. He said, what I always was impressed about you Jews is that you balance the threshold, is that you have a career, you're pushing for a career, and you don't relent, and we don't relent for a career. They don't invite us to work in law firms, we start our own law firms. They don't let us be doctors, we start our own hospitals. We don't invite us to join jobs, guess what? We don't make our own jobs. We can't work on Shabbos. You know what our grandparents do? They start their own firms. We don't relent on our beliefs. That's who we are. That's why we survive. We know that there's pieces of us that want to make it in the world. If we walk around like Pinchas ben Elazar, it ain't going to work all day. We can't be chopping people's heads off because they're going to parties at night during trainings. So there's a piece of us that stay within the threshold of the outside world. There's a piece of us that never gives in who we truly are. That never gives up what's going on the inside of our hearts. That never gives up what we truly believe. And the challenge of our lives is sitting at the threshold. Literally touching Hashem's name, because that's where he rests, threshold. And I think the goal of tonight, and the reason why I'm happy that you're here, and what I want to just give you the chizik with, is that whatever we're going to do tonight, hopefully Hashem's help will put the right words and we'll answer something, I hope. We'll give some advice, maybe some issues. But there's never going to be enough answers, ever. You're never going to be sitting around in any work environment and be able to say, I got it. When you say, I got it, usually you've retired the day before. The fight is what's great. What makes you great is that you stay at the threshold, is that you fight, is that you put yourself in circumstances where you're going to fight to do a great job, but you're never going to fight to give up your Yiddishkeit. It's that struggle, that Aryeh-type Yehuda struggle, is what makes us Yehudim. And our ability to step out into the world and not give in an inch on professionalism, but not give in an inch on spirituality, just that stance is the victory. And sometimes you win, and sometimes you lose. And you always need advice, and you always need halachic answers. But what I'm hoping that at the very least you do, is you always realize the importance of that threshold, and you always realize that just being at the threshold, that in itself is a value. And so that's the goal for tonight, to be able to give you guys an opportunity to ask questions, to voice opinions, to see what's really going on out there, and how to navigate. Some of you are out there, I guess some of you are going out into the world, and how to navigate both the outside and the inside. That's my spiel.
Glad to welcome Charlie Harari back. And I mentioned to Mr. Harari that I think we have like three times as many this time as they had last time. And next time we'll have to move to a large room when Mr. Harari comes. I always enjoy spending time with Mr. Harari. Remember the last time that Charlie was here, so he spoke about one of the things he addresses, somebody asked him when he learns. So he said, 5:30 in the morning. He said, 5:30 in the morning, no one bothers you. There's a blissfulness. So whenever I'm up at 5:30 in the morning and I'm learning, I think of Charlie. And when people call me 5:30 in the morning, I'm saying, why didn't they hear Charlie's rush?
Let them call me, by the way. I'll take care.
Things that we want to speak about, there are details and there are overarching issues. There are many details that you've asked, and we'll discuss those momentarily. I think there's an overarching issue that's very important for everybody to realize when you go into, it comes my way sometimes, when it goes into somebody else's business, when it goes into the working environment, it's very important that we go in with a very strong work ethic. And we're going to be asking people to cut us slack. We're going to be asking people to respect us. And we're going to be doing this differently. And we're going to be sometimes distinguishing ourselves from the people around us. And we're going to be asking them to respect us for it. The Aleph base is that we have to come in and be honest brokers. Be people of stellar integrity. Be people who have a strong work ethic. And we're working for somebody else, knowing we're working in somebody else's business. And we have to perform well for them. Right? And if one starts with that, and people can count on you, and they know that you're there at a high degree of professionalism, then you'll really immediately get their respect. And then when you have to explain to them that you're going to eat differently, that you can't go to a certain conference, that you have to be out early, put in a different context. It's extremely important, and I'll speak very, very openly, because when it comes from yeshiva environment, we come with a different orientation. Right? For example, the orientation that certainly when I was a student, and I doubt was any different right now, that we're continuously negotiating. Serious Ben Torah is continuously negotiating. Right? You go into a college class, and you're trying to figure out, what do I need to do in this college class to get the grade that I want to get, and still learn as much as I can learn, right? So you're really negotiating with the system, right? How can I have a certain goal, what I need to get in this class, how do I get it? That doesn't cut it in somebody else's business. Somebody else's business, you have to have a much stronger sense of a work ethic. You have a much stronger, there's a certain company that almost did not want to hire graduates from our yeshiva a few years ago. Because people are coming in with this kind of attitude. What do I need to do in order to be able? That's not the attitude we can have. And it required a pushback from some of our valabata in the company to say, no, not everybody's like that. And they were a little bit more, they were more careful in whom they took. And Baruch Hashem, I think we have regained our stature. That's, I think, a very important overarching comment to begin with. But I want to deal with some of the details that you've raised. And I think the best way to deal with it, for lack of a better term, bounce off each other. All right? So, for example, let's say we start with the issue of wearing a yarmulke for interviews and for work. So I can say that Al-Pidin, Rav Moshe, one of the earliest truths of Rav Moshe is that if one's afraid that one will not get the job, so one doesn't have to wear a yarmulke. If one's afraid that within one's business, within one's working situation, one will be less effective, then one's part of wearing a yarmulke. Is it the wisest thing to do? So that we'll ask Charlie to comment on that. I would think that in many, many situations, let's say, certainly there's certain situations where your boss may be comfortable with you wearing a yarmulke, but if you're going to be sent out from your bosses, from your company, to be a consultant in somebody else's company, so then that company may not be excited about you wearing a yarmulke. If you're, it could be that in your law firm they're happy that you wear a yarmulke, but they think that if you go to court with a yarmulke, you're not going to be servicing your client in the best possible way. So I would think that it should be possible. You have to do your research when you're going to interviews to find out how the yarmulke will play itself out. I would think that one could have an open conversation at some point in the interviewing process, maybe before one begins, when one gets hired, and say, look, as far as Jewish law is concerned, it's highly preferable, I'm more comfortable, but if it's not good for the business, not good for you, then I don't have to wear it. Right? I'd be more comfortable wearing it sometimes, but if I go out into a, if I'm sent to court or go to a client, I'm happy not to wear it. So I would think that that would be a conversation one could have, but I think when it comes to Lamasa, what do you have to say?
It's a really difficult conversation. This is probably one of the hardest ones out there. And the reason why it's so hard is because talking about religion is so, so legally problematic. So people won't come to you and say, we love you. If you just drop the beanie, you're in. They're never going to say that. They're going to say, especially if it's more, it was great, we love you, and then they won't call you back. It's also on the flip side is you think that, you know, it's like, you know, when you get the pimple for the first time and you think everyone's looking at you, and meanwhile no one's looking at you. We think that we're so self-conscious as yarmulke wearers, we assume that everyone's looking at us everywhere we go if we have a yarmulke on. Meanwhile, people don't even realize. And so the balance of what people are actually looking at and what we're going to hear is so difficult to figure out. Let me just sort of broaden it a little bit. The first question you ask yourself is, the place that you're going to work for, why are you ending up there? For some people, your grades are really strong or your opportunities are really robust, and so you're able to really pick. Some people don't have that option, and you're really trying to pull and try to get something. When you walk into an interview, your first question you ask yourself, if you can do this, is what is the environment like? Do I know anyone that worked here before? If I'm working at a big law firm and there's like 12 yarmulkes walking around, is that really going to affect me? But the question you should be asking yourself is, you try to get as specific as possible. If you really want to get the right information, ask yourself, who in the firm or in the company is wearing yarmulkes? I have a good friend of mine who's a very, very senior guy at a major accounting firm who's literally on his way to make partner, and he's a yarmulke wearing Jew. Because if you work really, I think, at a big firm, a big accounting firm in New York City, chances are the practice has been mostly that if you wear a yarmulke, it's okay. If you wear a shaytel, it's totally fine, because nobody knows. And if you tell them that you're wearing a shaytel, they're like, what? You're wearing a wig? I can't believe it. So women are totally cool on this one. When you work at a law firm, sometimes it could be different. Some law firms, some departments differ. Tax department generally has more yarmulkes, because there are more people that are, for some reason, that incline there because of the way they think. Whereas some of the transactional departments, like mergers and acquisitions that are very weekend intensive, usually have less. And so if you can, the first thing you do is you scope your area, if it's possible. Figure out who worked there. Generally, there's a firm guy that worked there. If you're working in New York City, unless it's a small place, chances are there's somebody that worked there or worked to there that is from. And I think you can have a conversation usually with that person, depending on how senior they are, with whether or not they will be comfortable or not with the yarmulke on. So first thing you do is you have to gather information. Just rolling into interviews is rough. Because if you roll in with one, that's going to destroy the job. Or you roll in without one and you could have gotten one, it's going to affect you. Because what you don't realize sometimes is that if you wear a yarmulke, if you really believe in Yiddishkeit, and you really believe Yiddishkeit's more important than the job that you have, meaning Hashem's going to give you your parnasa, your Jewish dadlus, and you take off your yarmulke maybe for the first time. The first time's okay, second time's okay. 3 weeks in, you start feeling a little weird. This is who you are. You believe in this. And when 80% of your day for the next X years is not with your yarmulke, it just feels off. Brachas and doing the whole little hand thing gone, it's just so off. And you can't, and the benching, and there's so many cheshbonos that you do. Can you learn if you have time in between, and benching with your hand over your head, and someone walks in and you get the hand over the head, then you're totally out. You know what I'm saying? You get caught with a bracha and your hand over your head, you're done. It's almost as bad as Usher Yatzah when you walk out of the bathroom, and you're mumbling to yourself. So you have to cheshbon that. And number two, also, the beautiful thing about a yarmulke, it's like a repellent for like bad things. People don't people are better into cursing around you. Women don't do things, like people, they don't ask you to, all the stuff that we're gonna talk about, believe it or not, there's a geder called your yarmulke, and people will just realize that you're one of those, you're like a priest, or a minister, or a rabbi, and you just like that stuff, and that's cool. And a lot of the conversations you're gonna have, like, I gotta leave early, and yes, there are 2 days of Sukkot, after the 2 days of Sukkot, I'm gonna take off the entire month of September, thanks so much. All those conversations, like, you don't have to have them, because somebody worked with somebody that was once religious, and so they get it. However, and this, I mean this seriously, and I'm saying this now, if we had this conversation 10 years ago, I wouldn't be saying this. The job market is tight. It's tough. And you're blessed to have a real posik in the room here, not me, who's giving you the halacha. The job market is tough. I brought a guy in from IU once who was a great guy, I'll never forget, and I brought him into the company, and he came in, and he didn't just wear a yarmulke. I don't know. I mean, he went all in on the yarmulke thing. I mean, like this massive srugi, he came in with the tzitzis tied around the belt, and I brought him in because I was going to get him in, and it took me so long, and the guy who was interviewing me was Italian, and he took one look at him, and he's like, I mean, a little black one's one thing, but like, he was just so taken by, he just couldn't hire him, it just couldn't work for this guy in the middle of Long Island, and this guy who was just coming out. So, there is no easy answer. It starts with you deciding who you are, and you making your own cheshbon. This is who I am. I'm going to get the job, or I'm not going to get the job, this is who I am. The second stage is your research. You gotta do research. You gotta find out. Some people don't care. The general counsel of the previous company I worked for, he liked yarmulkes. He used to tell me that when he see a yarmulke, he used to feel okay. Because he has this, he's a reformed guy. He went to Chabad. The rabbi was this brilliant, brilliant guy. And he said, I'm working on a deal. These guys are trained. This is what he told me. I never appreciate this. He said to me, what makes Orthodox Jews so interesting, he said, because you are built with laws. Our lives are laws. And we live our lives understanding laws. We know the difference between eating pork and missing minyan. They're both laws. We understand how to navigate what's broke, what is things you can't do, and what is not. He said to me, when I walk in the room, I see yarmulke, I know I'm going to be taken care of. So like I said, you never know. So the first thing you do is you figure out what you're comfortable with. Second thing you do is you research. If you can't get any research, you make a decision that you're going to live with. And it's not easy. If you're going to have to walk in without a yarmulke because you can't find the job and you think it's going to hurt you, you walk in without a yarmulke if that's the deal. But recognize, of course, if you go in without a yarmulke, what is so important is you early on have to set the rules that you are Orthodox. You have to let people know early on that you believe in this stuff. So you do things like, you know, make sure, you know, you give out, if you can, if it's not weird, a shalach manis, or you tell someone you're leaving for Shabbos, or whatever you do, or you say you're kosher. Because unless you set it forward, if you set your standard early, this is what you believe in, they'll respect you. If you show up 6 months later, and they're like, what, you're Orthodox? Like, they're not going to remember that you ate kosher here, or you went here. They're just not going to connect the dots, and it looks like you're being Orthodox when it's convenient for you. So no matter what you do, yarmulke or not, your orthodoxy, your observancy, should be your pride. And when you walk in, try to make sure before you make your decision, get as much information as possible to make an informed decision of what you're doing.
Any comments?
Moshe's tshuva was even, if a person could choose a career like Achila, that the rest of the career would entail not wearing yarmulke, or just for like an interview, to get in, and then, and certain situations afterwards, like a court, like a court appearance or something, then it's okay not to wear one. Or he said, like, no, you could wear one, and even throughout the career, that career choice, if there's, you know, there's hefsets involved all along the way by wearing a kippah, you could still.
Yeah, Rosh's point is that wearing the yarmulke is wearing the yarmulke all the time is a minhag Yisrael, and it's of the status that if it will impact on my parnasa, so then I'm allowed to relax that minute. So that could mean, you also have to realize that being able to wear a yarmulke wherever you are is maybe 40 years old. In the 60s, people did not, you just couldn't do it. Doctors did not wear yarmulkes. If you look at professionals who are a little bit my senior, who are now presently in their late 60s, early 70s, hardly anybody wore a yarmulke in the professional world. Lawyers, and it's a luxury that we have because of the ethnicity that's happening in America. So not only, I think that was Rav Moshe's point, but you also have to realize that until my generation, people did not wear yarmulkes and work. This wasn't done. I want to apologize. The reason I'm texting only because I'm on call at the mikveh. So I'm dealing with something that's actually going on at the mikveh. So that's why I would not, hopefully not be so rude. Sorry, go ahead.
What should we do about our tzitzis? Tuck it in, leave it out. Does that make a difference?
So, Al-Pidin, I've said the Chavetz Chaim was the one who was the strong advocate of having tzitzis out. If you look at most Litvish Rosh Yeshivas, they did not wear the tzitzis out. When I was growing up and we still had European Rosh Yeshivas, they rubbed the Navi tzitzis out. Most Litvish Yeshivas did not wear the tzitzit. So, even though the Chavetz Chaim makes a very strong argument, I would think that as long as one doesn't wear them in a bizyonistic way, one finds a way that they shouldn't just hang down, puts them in a pocket or something, I mean inside. So I would think that it certainly is not worth risking anything in the professional world of one's livelihood in order to have them out.
I would agree. I think one thing that it's hard to appreciate, and this is the hard part, and it's not an easy answer. When you get into a job, what the Rav said in the beginning was 1,000%. People hire people that they can trust. The way you're going to be successful is if your employer looks and says, I can trust this guy. He's not going to backdoor me. He's not going to just do the work good enough to get out. As soon as they can trust you, you're invaluable. Once you become invaluable, a lot of this other stuff starts to go away. You start to navigate. You say, if I'm in the office six times, if you're having a conversation with your boss after being there 6 months, you go, let me ask you a question. Do you mind in the office if I wear a yarmulke? A lot of this stuff goes away. And so the beginning is really the key. The key is being able to establish you. That's how life works sometimes. You see a guy in black and white, you see a guy wearing this, and we're not perfect enough to see through their clothes into their human, into their soul. Humans don't have that yet necessarily that vision. So when you walk into a room, the first few times, whatever it is, people have a hard time seeing past your external. Now, some people won't care, which is what we said before. But as soon as they get to know you, all that other stuff just goes away. And so what I find is that if you're really doing your job well, the better you do your job, the more you'll get on the religion side. So you think it's the other way. People are trying to always pull and saying, I got to make sure I have this. It's the other way. The more you are responsible for your job, the more everyone will be like, sure, you're entitled to. I mean, you're allowed to be a Yankee fan, right? So instead of being a Yankee fan, you could be a God fan. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can choose to have a family. Work isn't 24/7. Even big law firms that say we sweatshop you, it's not really true. You can't work 24/7 or you'll die. Work really is, for the most part, during the 5 days of the week and during most of the 10 hours of the day. There are exceptions of big deals, and there are times you have to step it up. But most people have the ability to have a life outside work. The minute you show that you're going to take those work hours and give it to the person with true integrity, you could almost count it. It's complete correlation to their ability to allow you to look a certain way and talk a certain way and act a certain way and have all your craziness that you have, because no one really cares. They just want to make, it's the beautiful thing about business is that nobody cares about your life. They just care about their business. So they're not marrying you. So, they're not have to worry about bringing, if you're doing your business, they'll give you your personal life. And so it's hard, but the more you can sort of ease in all the extra stuff, the better. Which is why I always like to start my jobs, if you have a choice, by the way, if you're choosing to start your job in September and there's like 20 yontifs coming up in September, start in October. You lose the month of pay. You'll get it. I'm saying better if you have like, I don't know, some people do this. You work for a big company, they say you can start September 5th, September 10th. So some people say, listen, if it's a religious day, it's paid. So I come in September 1st and I get like 20 straight pay days. I love it. It's wonderful. It works like 80% of the times. But 20% of the times you walk in, they're like, welcome to the team. So happy to have you. Here's a new deal. And you're like, oh, I'm sorry. See you later for a month. And they're like, and we're paying you? So the more when you first walk in, you could just be like everybody else, and you but professional, I don't mean going to those parties, I mean professional, you will find you can bring in a lot. I'm not what to learn for, but I brought in a lot of stuff in my jobs, like a ton. Like videos and shears and like lunch and learns and everything. And schma things we were doing, but just, it took me time to slowly ease that in. Then they figured I was weird, but at that point it was too late.
You know, you're gonna have a challenge, also a new challenge, and that is that, this is my Balabatan telling me, that because of certain scandals in the Orthodox community, so we are not enjoying the stellar reputation that we had 10 years ago. My Balabatan tell me that they've seen a very significant drop in the last 10 years. 10 years ago, a guy walked in with a big yarmulke, then he immediately earned some points of respect, and they said, we can trust this guy. And that's changed, unfortunately, to our great discredit. Different Balabatan tell me that to some extent it could depend on what yarmulke you're wearing. It was interesting. There is some discerning of that, but you certainly have a challenge that you're gonna have to be mekadeshem shemayim, and you're gonna have to you and your generation are gonna determine very much whether we gain back that level of integrity which we had 10 years ago, and which we will. But you have to realize that what Charlie's saying is that there's even more of a focus if you come in with a yarmulke of. We're not as sure as we were 10 years ago.
Totally true. Mr. Harari, as from Jews, we tend to mention Hashem either knowingly or unknowingly in our speech a lot. Baruch Hashem, Mirth Hashem, Mezuz Hashem. Let's say, like I was in an interview today, and like it's regular speech, so you wouldn't say it in Hebrew, you'd say like God willing or thank God in your thoughts and like make them uncomfortable, doesn't matter. Or,
that's a great question. You know, to me the challenge is that I said this last year, since I'm Sephardi, I believe that Hashem gives me all my money. I really believe in my heart that the reason why, who is the most successful Jew in all of Judaism financially? Better, Yosef, wasn't he? Was there anyone that controlled the world's food? I mean, there was no one bigger. I believe, straight up in Rashi, look at it, I believe the reason why he was so successful, it's Mamish and Rashi, Kodesh Baruch Hu is with him, why? Kishem Shemayim Shigur B'fiv, period. When God's with you in your voice, when you're with him all day, the paths are open. That's my belief. So I try as much as I can to bring him everywhere. Now, the whole Hashem thing doesn't work because no one knows him except for us. And they don't know what you've been saying because Baruch Hashem, there's so many words they can't pronounce. It's so complicated. And so that all goes. The question is, God willing. What I've found is that sometimes in our Baruch Hashem speak, it's like Baruch Hashem, Mirtz Hashem, you know what I'm saying, Be'ezus Hashem, and then you have like one word in the sentence of Hashem. That doesn't work. But I've found, I gotta tell you honestly, I love God, and I have no problem telling people how much I love God. Now, I toned it down in the beginning, but I don't, it's not religion, I'm not preaching religion to people. I just happen to believe in God. And so I say things like God willing, or God, please God, but I try to say them in a way that are very matter-of-fact, so it's not imposing. And when you live in New York City, especially in the East Coast, you find like there's like this tension sometimes to God. But when you get onto into the real world, I find that most people generally relate well to him. And so if you feel that it's something that is part of your speech, I would translate it. And I think if you say it, I don't think it's a problem at all. And in fact, I think if it's translated, it makes you feel, I think, it gives you a sense of humility, and it gives you a sense of God, if you're wearing a yarmulke especially, of godliness. Meaning, and it really does have to mesh. Meaning you can't say God willing and you won't, I'm saying, but, and then next sentence curse, or tell a joke that doesn't work. But if you're willing to take that stand, not in a, and this is so important, not in a condescending way, which of course no one will, but to be very diligent, but just in a complimentary or gratitude way towards God, I find, and again, you have to check your surroundings if people get uncomfortable, but I find it, there's an aura of respect that people of faith have. When you're a, people used to come to my office all the time that are Presbyterians and Christians, and usually in times of crisis or pain, and they would say things like, what do you guys think? What do you believe? Because we don't appreciate that, how much the world, if we really understood this, we'd be different people, I think. We don't appreciate how much the world, the faith-based world, respects us. We're so Holocaust-driven. And my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. But we have become so Holocaust-driven in that if they're not Jewish, they hate us, that we don't appreciate that there's a lot of people that are not Jewish and respect us a lot. And when you hold yourself like a godly person, and it stems, meaning this is who you are, with pride, I think, it depends on circumstances, I think there's a little, like the rabbi was saying, you have that, there's a little bit of, you have a little thing to you that I think people respect. And so if that's part of your conversation, I would continue it, I would just translate it, and make it a little more matter of fact than it would happen otherwise. But if that's who you are, don't change. You know, it's funny. It's funny. This is like, I think this is our job everywhere. Everywhere. God bless us. We're great people. We become the way we become sometimes because we're stubborn. But that stubbornness sometimes broadens itself a little bit, like online sometimes in the airports and other places where you see a guy in a yarmulke doing things that you're literally cringing by. And more importantly, you see people around saying things. So I think it's a general question. There's only one thing you really could do. You can never rat another guy out. Meaning, I'm not saying you will, but you can never say, you know, that's, you know, unfortunate, or you can't put on someone else down. What I typically try to do is if I see something happening, is I try to counter it to that person. So if you're seeing a bunch of guys leave on Friday at 1 o'clock in the summer times, when you really don't need to leave till 5, because it's their Shabbos observers and they need to get up to the country or whatever, they want to leave early. If you see the person that's looking over, now it's not fair to you, but Kol Yisrael Reivim, this is what we do, we take care of each other. You go over to the person that is about to, you know, sort of sigh and say, by the way, I just want you to know that I'm around Saturday night, if you need some extra help or whatever it is, or you're trying to compensate because you have to. Because there is this mentality that if I can get away with it, I will. The way the Rav opened up is exactly, if you can just take nothing except for his intro, it's a win. This is it. We have this mentality of, if I can get away with it, I will. And I get extra points by Hashem if I can find another hour of learning. But in the process of that, there's someone sitting at their desk that's literally under his breath muttering a curse to me. I don't think that's right. I think we have an obligation. It's gneva. If someone's paying you to work. But when you see someone else doing it, the only thing I think you can do is you have to go the other way. You have to double up. You have to show him that we're not all like that. And you show him by example. And as soon as you do, it's amazing. Is the stereotype falls away. Because there's no stereotype anymore. Because here's somebody that's, it can't be the yarmulke, it must be the person. And when you're working in an environment with other people like that, to the extent to which you can try to explain to them how important it is that they're making Kiddush Hashem wonderful, if not, this is part of our job to sort of be on lookout, and whether it's fair or not, to overly compensate, even I think in times where it's not really our fault.
I think you should be proactive and approach the other Jewish fellows and try to reason with them. I think it's important that you should point out to them that they're doing a great disservice, possibly to themselves professionally, and to other Jews who will be in the company, and you should try. You have to try your hardest to try to to prevail upon them. And also, sometimes it's very often, more often than it's just not right. They're not, there are issues of Geneva involved. Let's say you have, one of the questions over here is, what, how does it all fit in if there are people who are identify themselves as being less religious, conservative reform, right? So you have other Jews in the company. So how does one negotiate that, those differences? So I think it's very important. I don't think it's different than in any other situation where our goals are never to, if a person is not religious primarily because they weren't raised religious, then we're never putting them down, God forbid. We always see ourselves as having this tremendous opportunity which they didn't have. And that's the way, and when it comes up, I think that's how one presents it. And that there are different, I think everybody understands that within religious life, there are different levels of observances. So they'll understand that it's about us as well.
I think that the reform conservative question is really an amazing question. And I think there's two things you need to fully understand. It is very easy. I think a mistake we make as people is we judge each other based on how we look and what we see on the outside. This happens a lot, especially post-Israel. You go to Israel, we have friends from high school, they come back from Israel, guys go this way for the first year YU, then they go this way, then the second year YU, they change how they look, they change this, and everyone's judging each other the whole way through, and then it's time to date and forget that, because it's like finding a box, if it's a box, to find the thing, and if you're like this, you're like this. We live in a society, for some reason, because we have so many rules, that we're like in this space where we're just like trying to figure out where we fit in the whole world of the Jewish span. That's okay for ourselves, or it's not okay for ourselves, but we do it. When you get out to the world, you have to understand something. Everybody has a background, and everyone has a story, and you don't know it. I know people that are from people that are completely atheists, and I don't blame them an iota, because they're not really atheists. They just have family members that have either abused them or have been abused. So you see them on the outside, what they're doing, and you're like, horrible. But when you actually know the story, you just feel for them. Because most people want to connect deeply to something deeper than themselves. It's not that they are wrong. It's that their story is different than our story. Now, here's where it comes to be crucial. We think that what we say gets judged by the words we say. It's not true. What we say gets judged by the thoughts that we have behind the words. If you're talking to somebody in your office that's a reformed conservative and you speak in a tone or you think in a place of judgment, it's going to come across. And there is nothing more reprehensible to a Jew than another Jew judging them. Try it right now. If someone walks into you and says, by the way, nice, blue. I don't think so. Welcome to hell. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's white and black. Didn't you read a tshuva on this? You'll be like, really? It's the worst to judge it. There are people in that room that you're going to be working with that are, like you said earlier, going to have an experience about a guy that's an Orthodox Jew making a comment. Oh, by the way, we have Passover. Do you guys have Passover too? Because I know you eat. Oh, you do. Oh, then happy holidays to you and all yours. And this conservative person who's like, believes in the Rabbanu Shel, and she's like, what? It's okay. So her, maybe you're not going to eat by her Seder, but she's so offended. When you see people in your office that are not Orthodox, they may come at you. They may say, well, I'm going to be here on Saturday. You never respond. Ever, anything other than, it's totally fine. That's, everyone has the ability to practice their beliefs, and everyone is wonderful, and they're the best they can be, and I appreciate that. The only way you do this is with openness and kindness. And when you relate to people like that, you know what's going to happen? As soon as they feel that you're not judging them, you're going to be a magnet for them. You have to be prepared for that, because they want to know. Most people out there that didn't go to our, that's not part of our system, but went to some public school somewhere, and is now a connected Jew, they really just want to know. They don't have the opportunity. And what you'll find in your office is if you don't judge, remember, you have to believe in what you believe in, you stay strong to your beliefs, you don't impose them on anybody else, you're just proud of them, and you're stronger in your conviction. If you don't judge them, what'll happen is they won't judge you. And if you do judge them, or you make comments in any which way, you're asking for disaster. Because that is, to some people, worse than anything that you can do for them, is questioning their beliefs.
To ask a sort of twofold question, hopefully the answer hashkafically and halachically, how should one react to a situation where they're forced to, let's say, go out with their boss for lunch with the client at a non-kosher restaurant or something along those lines?
The issue then becomes an issue of Maris Ayin, right?
Exactly.
So the rule of Maris Ayin is that if the Gemara calls it Shavcho Mochir Cholov, if there's something happening, if you do something which clearly shows that you're there not to eat, so to speak, right? So then you don't have to be, then it's mutter, right? The classic example is you have milk on the table and it's a fleishik meal. So you put the box on the table that says powdered milk. The Gemara's time was put a coconut on the table, right? Gemara says that a person's moving a ladder in Yom Tov. So it looks like he's going to fix his roof. The Gemara says, yeah, but if you have the box on the ladder, which is used to put the chickens in, and you're allowed to do that in Yom Tov, so then that shows that it's mutter. So the same thing I would say over here as well, that if you're going to a meeting and you're wearing your business suit, and it's the middle of the day, I think anybody passing by says, that's a business meeting, right? Now, the question, it can get murky and be a problem if it's an after-hours dinner, or if it's, and if for some reason you're working as a team on Sunday, and they say, oh, let's finish up in the restaurant, and then you're dressed down. That's the problem.
Can you have, like, lettuce or something like that?
No, you can't. The only things you can have in a non-kosher restaurant, as far as I know, the only things you could have are whole fruits, apples and oranges, and packaged yogurts, and other things like that. There's very, very little that is unpackaged that you could have in a non-kosher restaurant. In the situation, you may have to dress up, and then maybe Charlie will give us more eitzah, so to speak. But if it's an off-hours meeting and you're going to be going in, that could be a problem. It's not clear that you're there for business purposes. It could be that the entire setting, it could be that even though you're dressed down, but the way that it's conducted could be. I think that it's mutter if it's clearly, if somebody walking by says that's a business meeting, then it's mutter. If somebody walking by says, I don't know, looks like they're having a good time with it, so then that's a problem.
So one thing that I usually do is you can always carry your briefcase, so that's, you always go with you everywhere. And as much as you can, you dress up. The one thing that I would say to everybody as a piece of practical advice, never choose the order in from the kosher restaurant then. Right? That's always an option they'll give you. Why don't we order you from Luigi's Eagles? It comes after everyone else gets their meals, and it's in 700 pounds of tinfoil. There is nothing worse than having to get rubber chicken. You know what I'm saying? Not worth it. This is my advice, and it's practical, and just trust me on this one. Your first day on the job, go to CVS, and you buy 4 bags of pretzels. And if you're on a diet, almonds. Keep it in your desk. If you're going to a non-kosher restaurant, have a bunch of pretzels, get a little full, order Diet Coke. If you want to go crazy, have real Coke. You know what I'm saying? If you want to be nuts, you can go. I mean, like, it. Be known. Trust me. I've been here. I've been to every one of these. I went to the OU Kosher seminars. I spent time in Baltimore for 3 years every week, basically living in a non-kosher restaurant. That's where everyone ate. It's the easiest. You're the Diet Coke guy. And they love you. I told you the story last year. I was no pork Diet Coke guy, and you're the Diet Coke guy, or the Coke guy. But that's what you do, and you'll make up the food someplace else. You stay consistent. You're cool. You're having a good time. You're not. And this is very important. You're not like, what is that? Oh, Oh. Looks amazing. Oh, there's butter on that? Because we can't have butter, but I love how that goes on that steak. Is that, wow, is that creme brulee after a steak? Because there's none of that. There's, I am who I am, I'm happy to be here. You know, give me 4 Diet Cokes and I'm good to go. They don't care how you eat. They don't care what you eat. They don't care about you. They care about themselves. And they just don't want to feel uncomfortable because some rabbi's in the room making them feel like they're going to hell. As long as you're happy with who you are and you're confident and you're like, it's cool, I got Diet Coke. No, it's complicated, I'm okay. The only time I ever had a problem, and you pull this out in the last possible case scenario. It's if you're in a place where they serve you something, now you're stuck because they plate the meals, right? That's when it gets complicated. So if you're ever in a situation where you're stuck, pull the diet. No one gets kosher, everybody gets being a vegan. Everybody gets being on a diet. If you're on a carb diet, they're like, oh, you know, you're awesome. You know what I'm saying? Like, I should really watch my weight. You know what I'm saying? I'm on a strict diet. I'm so sorry. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know, I don't know what's in here. My wife will kill me if you're married and if you're a man. My wife, if you're not married, it's cool. Pull it also. Always blame your wife. It's all good. My wife will kill me if I don't drop 5 pounds for my brother-in-law's wedding. What? They're cool. But remember, nobody cares what you eat. They care how uncomfortable you make them feel. If they're plowing down on a steak, they don't want to feel like the rabbi's looking at them. So you walk in, you're happy. I always go with the soda, and that's who you are, and you'll see after 1 or 2 times, smooth. And then treat yourself to whatever a good restaurant is around here, and you build a tasha.
That's how the situation that comes up where the every 2-3 days, the team at 5 o'clock, 5:30 goes to the local bar. So the question is, how important is participating in this scenario? Al pidin, the machlokas of poskim, the Ramah says that if it's, the Ramah seems to say that it's mutter. The Chodesh says that it's aser. Chacham Sodom says that he thinks it's mutter, but it's not the wise thing to do. Certainly, from a the personal conduct perspective, it's I would be very concerned about it. From a family perspective, I'd be very concerned about it. And he's getting home a little bit later, and so if it's something which is crucial for advancement in one's business, so then we'd have to learn how to negotiate it so that one does it in a very measured way. If it's really not important for one's professional skills, so then I would think one should avoid it altogether.
So the bar scene, I think, harder than the restaurant scene, because, you know, in our circles, we don't do this. I mean, we have different ways of hanging out. Believe it or not, it's usually after shul. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have time where we schmooze, or we have set places where we all congregate on Shabbos, whatever it is. In the outside world, going to the bar is really the place where many of them go to relax. It's seen as like an extension of the conference room many times, where if they're having a conversation, everyone goes around and gets a drink. It's what happens on weekends. A bar to somebody who's is more connected to Yiddishkeit seems off. A bar to somebody who's in the secular world is not. It's what you do to just hang out. It's where you go to meet. That's how it works. So you have to understand that the bar scene is much more complicated than the restaurant scene. I agree completely. I think like the way the Rav's saying is, I think, exactly right. The first thing you have to understand is you have to get down the information. Half the time when you go out to bars, they don't really care who's there. They really don't. The team build, people just care about money. They want you to be, they want to win, they want good employees, they want the cogs of the wheels to turn. That's what they care about. Whether you like them or don't like them, team building, a lot of that stuff is just like, they have to say it because it's 2013 and like, you know, they get checked somewhere that they have to do these things and it's part of their like new culture. But like, net, you know what I'm saying? Like, tachlis, if you're really a great associate, you're a great associate, and you're invaluable. So you have to be very careful. I would think half the bar scenes are completely irrelevant. If you're awesome in the office, and you got stuff going on, and they know you have a family, key. If you have a family, let them know. The first time they think you're Amish, then after that, they're cool with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you've got multiple kids by your 30s, like no one has multiple kids by their 30s. But as soon as you have multiple kids at their 30s, meanwhile, you're connecting to the partners, and they get that at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, you want to go home to see your kids. That's not religious. That's just being a normal human being and a dad. So the more they see you as a holistic person, the less that scene comes in. Here's where it gets challenging, and I'll defer back to the Rav on this. The hardest parts of saying no to the bar scene are the intimate bar gatherings. It's where you have a meeting with, like, your boss. It's where, it's not really the part, once you have more than six people, you can blow it off, for the most part, I think. Maybe the first time you can't, because it's the first time you're doing it, it's training, but if you're working in the company more than 15 minutes, and you've got six people in a room, I think it's a waste of time. Because that's already team building, and team building's nonsense. It's about how good you do it in your job. But if you're invited to a bar, and I'd love to get the Rav's opinion, if you're invited to a bar with your boss, one-on-one, or your boss and your colleague, that's real to them. That's like, we need a place to go hang out. That's like going to Starbucks for them. And so that's really sometimes where they see, like, it's an opportunity for real bonding. And so in those situations, you have to be very clear. I mean, if you can go, I'm going to defer to the Rav, but if you do go, you have to be very careful what you drink. Very careful. More importantly, if you drink in the first place, but what you drink, more importantly, you also have to be very careful, I think, that you're going for the conversation. And I try, to me, I was very lucky that very early on in my career, I was able to navigate a lot of that stuff in, and I took risks, I gotta tell you. I took a lot of risks. I passed a lot of bar scenes up, a lot. And again, don't rely on me, it's up to Hashem. I was never once penalized by Hashem in terms of my career for taking these risks. I never went to any of these clubs, I never went to any bars, I didn't do any of this stuff. I got married when I was young, I had kids when I was young, they knew I was a dad, and they knew right away that I was gonna work hard, and when I had a chance to go home at night, if it wasn't a team reason, I was booking out, and that is important. But I'd love to get the Rav's opinion, halachically and hashkafically, the real question you have is when you get invited out to an intimate conversation with two or three people that's seen as almost like an extension of the office to go to the bar. That is the only thing I think that you need to think about. Everything else I think is just, again, outside maybe the first 3 months of the first training and everyone getting together and not wanting to stand out. But after they get to know your work, I think you can brush most of that stuff off.
So I would think in that case where this could be an important step in one's parnasa, I think one could do it, one could go there. I would think that you look at it as a one-time kind of a thing. Or a kind of thing that happens once in a project. But if it's the kind of thing that it's happening with any frequency at all, then I think you have to have a conversation and say, no, this is... And put the cards on the table. I'd rather do it in Starbucks. I'd rather... I think also there are bars and there are bars. I think that this, the kind of bar that this would happen in, would be a more upscale kind of a place where it's quiet, there's not a lot of stuff going on over there. Nevertheless, it is distant from the way that Klal Yisrael functions. So if it's happening with any kind of frequency, and if one sees oneself enjoying it, well, you have to monitor yourself as well. Once you see yourself as looking forward to it, then you know that you got to step out of this, because that's that's why liquor is addictive, right? So the moment you see yourself, hey, invite me again. That's good. That means what you're really responding to is the good feeling that you have afterward, and then you know that you're on a bad road. So then you have to pull back for sure.
And just to reiterate that point, we'll go back to questions. Really, really, really understand that outside the first few months, your parnasa is based on your performance. This extra stuff is really recent stuff, and so you can really, if with a little proactivity, you can divert it. Like what the Rav said, exactly right. If there were times where my boss said, let's go out for a drink, I went straight to the hotel scene, because I knew that the hotel scene is much different than the bar scene. So I knew that you're working for a real company, the guy's got a couple of bucks. The difference between a $2 bottle of beer at a local, St. McAllen's or whatever they call it, and and a pub and you know, the Regis or whatever. So you can be proactive. You can say, I'd love to go out. You mind if I book places? How's the duh? So your ability to navigate and realize that this is not really going to ultimately make a difference in your career gives you a little bit more comfort on that. Yep.
This summer, I ran into a lot of times just like shaking woman's hand, and I kept saying that I was sick. Is that advisable? And what if you don't make it awkward? And like, how good are the hetairim for shaking woman's hand in the office?
So I would again, I'll feed in shaking woman's hand when it's stretched out as you're discussing in a cordial fashion. So alpidin is mutter. There might be a minug that Klal Yisrael has not to do it. Maybe. But again, where the alternative is making someone, forget about your parnasa, making someone feel terrible. They put their hand out and it's hanging there. So just having rachmanis and another tzelem elokim. So I would say that someone, and everyone takes the hand, all right? And I don't see a problem with that. And I think that's what's happening right now is a much bigger problem. So I would think that the bottom line is, in that kind of situation, take the hand. Again, if at some point when you're proving yourself, you'd say, no, I'm uncomfortable with it. I don't want to make anybody feel bad. So I'm certainly will take somebody else's hand that they shouldn't be embarrassed. But if you're in the team with women and it becomes a common thing, at some point you may want to have a conversation. But initially, I don't think it's a problem. The problem that you have is that nowadays it's not handshakes. Right? Nowadays it's hugs. Right? It's very, very common nowadays to have cordial hugs. So that I think is a problem. That's a very difficult thing. I don't think there's such a thing as a cordial hug as far as Allah is concerned. But it's far more commonplace and much more meaningless nowadays. Nevertheless, I don't think that one can let slide anyway.
And a lot of the same thing is being proactive, meaning you can. There's sometimes where there are sometimes like the Rav said where you know the hand goes out in public. It's really hard without making it. And the whole like I love my wife thing, you know, may not resonate as much. But you have to be proactive. If you're in a situation where you may get the whole kiss thing, it's a problem. And that happens sometimes, where people are very, very cordial. And so the key is to be proactive. Sometimes you have things in your hands. Sometimes you come to a meeting and your hands are full. Sometimes you set the hug. You could, depending on where, you can set the high. You do the little fake bow high thing, you know what I'm talking about? If you go and go, you know, someone's in, they go, oh, hi, how are you? How are you doing? Not too much so that you look Chinese. I'm sort of like, you know what I'm saying? Like, the little, like, hi, you know what I'm saying? You can sometime in situations set you, you're, and this is great because you have to be makdim shalom to people, so you can actually be doing the mitzvah and getting extra bonus points in the back end. Like, you can literally be in a situation where you can set the high. So, it's being proactive. It's preparing for situations and trying to not make anyone feel... That's exactly the goal. The goal is... The game is at least embarrass them as possible and as least touch as possible. That's the game.
If it's mutter al pidin, then why even bother with even later on trying to reduce it if it's mutter?
It probably is a minute to try to avoid it. But the question's well placed. I'm not sure if... That have to do with your own personal comfort. The question well placed. It's mutter, and to avoid somebody else being embarrassed, you have to realize there's another thing which is happening. When you make an issue, I'm saying that you may not want to have the conversation, when you make an issue with the handshake, you are overloading what is for them a totally meaningless gesture. And you have to be very careful how you handle it. Because you could come off as like an over anxious, an over sexed person. They just stretch their hand out, and you start saying, oh, "I don't really shake a woman's hand." They don't know where you're coming from, right?
Very true.
So you could end up just looking very weird. Not being well all the time also is not good. It's not good. Look, the Jews are having the plague. It's not not a good thing. Take the hand, and I would think that if you're in a situation where you look around the room and she hugged the first three people, then you put your hand out to create a handshake. I would think if everybody's clothed, I would think a light tap on the shoulder is in this category of a casual handshake. I would think so.
All I would say is the key is not to embarrass anybody. The rub is exactly right. You look so weird if you're just taking a handshake and saying, this is the reason why I don't do this is because of just no embarrassment, no issue, try to downplay it. There are times where I've been in situations where people have been trying to be very friendly, and it's a slope. Just be mindful of it. Be mindful that that's how people relate, and that's all I'm saying is that just make sure that you're mindful of circumstances as it, especially if you're working on a small team, in different, you know, stuff like this, you know. So the more they know you're Orthodox, the better you'll be.
Let me ask Charlie the question about yichud, because this is a halach is much clearer in this, right? I have a female boss, and she wants to have a meeting, and her office is a closed office. So, al pi din, the only wiggle room you have is if you live in the same place as you're working. So there are many gedolim. The Chibina was one of them who's make old ishto v'ir. My wife's in town. That's an approach to be makel, and you can be samech that. There is another approach which can only be somechan b'shas adchak, and that is if the person, if your boss would stand to lose their position if they would do anything inappropriate. So then there are poskim would say that that is a powerful enough shmira, so to speak, that would allow you to be in the room with her alone. But that's the only time to be somechan when you really have no other alternative. So can you have how would the conversation go?
Yichud thing, a lot of times, I find very rarely are you, I mean, this happens, very rarely are you alone with somebody in an office. I find that most of the times in office environments, there are always people around. It's rare that I have found that the situation works out. I mean, it happens, but it's rare that you're talking and you're working with somebody in an environment where there's nobody around at all. Usually office buildings, if they're open, there are people walking around. If you're traveling somewhere, usually you're traveling together. Yichud is not something that I think I've really, maybe it's something that's happening now. I haven't really grappled with it, mostly because I think most of the people that I've worked with have either been in teams, or my bosses have always traditionally, just my way it worked out was guys. My luck. But I think that usually people are usually, hopefully, you know, around.
Can we talk about shaving during the 3 weeks and the 9 days in the office? And also, I guess, last year it wasn't really an issue because the Shabbat was on Sunday, but how to go about, you know, I guess, either working on the Shabbat and also wearing different shoes.
Shaving during Sfira, if it would impact your parnasa, then you shave. And there's a lot to be somachan. Again, Rav Moshe's approach is that if it's a minog, then and it could impact on your parnasa, so then one's allowed to shave. The Rav certainly held the same status as the Yud Beis Chodesh. So the same thing would be true for the 3 weeks. What's very, very hard to negotiate al pi din is the Shavu Shecholmo, the 9 days. So then, there Rav Moshe does have, I would say Rav Moshe's position is that one cannot shave then. I would think that it's broadly accepted that people do shave, it seems to me. So I'm not sure Al Pi Din exactly how one can negotiate that. Tisha B'Av itself, the easiest thing is if you would deal with it as a Yom Tov that you take off. If you explain to the people we have a national day of mourning, and you can't come in, or you can come in the afternoon, but I would think that one should try as much as possible to negotiate that to treat that as a day that one does not go into the office. Both Al Pi Din, practically. The specific issue of wearing shoes, that nowadays is much less of an issue. You can buy shoes that look decent that are plastic and rubber, so that I'm not sure that's going to be a problem. I think Al Pi Din, Tisha B'Av is not a day that we should be working. If you have to work, if it'll challenge your parnasa, it'll challenge a client or a portfolio in the business, so then after Chatzos you can go in.
As a rule, I got this advice two, three years into my career, but it's been the best advice I got. Treat Purim and Tisha B'Av like Sukkos. Give them fair warning, say this is what you believe. Obviously other people work on that day, but the more you try to maneuver to take that day off, the better you'll be. Because those 2 days are, it's just, working those days are anyways miserable if you're in the office. But you can get those days, you have sick days, you have personal days, you can give them enough time, whatever it is. Negotiate if you can for those days off, even if it means that you take less vacation days, because they're disasters. And more importantly on Tisha B'Av is that you come in, you're like, you're exhausted. You know, Tisha B'Av, you can really speak at the end of Tisha B'Av, you know what I'm saying? So you're performing at such a low level, and your breath stinks. It's bad news. Stay home as much as you can.
A lot of these issues are sort of very specific shilas, circumstances. Just sort of going back to what you said originally about, I guess, threshold and feeling like you're between two different worlds, so I can just maybe ask you to comment on, I guess, these two larger issues. The first being that somebody's working in a law firm or a financial house, so they're basically spending, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day for 40, 50 years, you know, in an environment where the larger tone is perhaps different than what we want to strive to be as Jews. There's more aggressiveness, the values perhaps are somewhat different, and how do you sort of, you know, live in that world at the same time, sort of constantly, just for instance, for your own life, still sort of like reinforcing sort of the values of that are sort of important to us specifically. And secondly, a guy who's sort of coming from yeshiva, who's used to being in a base meditation learning, and then all of a sudden you're davening at sort of 5:30 in the morning, or you're learning 5:30 in the morning on the train, where really your life doesn't really sort of feel like it's revolving around Avodas Hashem. How does sort of still feel like you're learning and you're growing and you're, you know, even though most of your life and your days really don't revolve around things that sort of look like they're sort of God-focused or God-related, sort of still feel like you're in a growth-oriented mode, even though that's not sort of practically what you're doing day in and day out, just as far as classic forms of Avodas Hashem. So do you have any thoughts on those two areas?
So, I mean, this is the question, right? This is the question, because all the stuff that we're talking about really falls if you're not, if you've lost the connection to who you are. I'll tell you what I was told, and it makes a big difference. It's very important that everybody always is constantly reevaluating what they want to do in their lives and what they stand for. That's more important than the money you make, because you'll make money or you won't make money. That's not up to you. Truth is, money's really up to the Ron Shalom. All this parnassus stuff is just a game that we play. MS, you're going to make your money, or you won't make your money. And we have to go through these machinations. The problem is that many of us get lost along the way. And unless you're constantly taking stock with where your life is and where your life is going, you run this major risk of getting lost in the quicksand of just two more years and. As soon as this happens, then. When I make partner, then. And what happens to any of us is that we start to live bidyeved lives. Our lives are bidyeved. I really should be learning, but now I'm spending 18 hours working, I'm a bidyeved. I really was once sitting in a place that was cool with Torah, and I'm sitting in a place with people that are cool with animals. I'm living in a bidyeved life, and maybe if I give enough money to the yeshiva, then I can maybe, you know, get in the back door. That's not how you can't live your life this way. You just can't. because you just won't be great at your life. And if you're not great at your life, you're not going to be great at anything. Your life needs to be lechatchila, which means you have to figure out where you're going and what you need. And if you need to make parnasa, and you have a rav that you're attached to, and your rav says, go make parnasa, then the hours that you're making parnasa, your job is to infuse as much of you, which is tzelem elokim, into what you're doing. And so there are people around that are going to be aggressive, but the jobs that you have could be holy. I'm saying we had tanayim that walked around and worked for a living. We had people that were able to makadish what they did. And it doesn't mean that you're always the guy who's, you know, not working hard. It means that your stance towards work is that this is a lechatchila part of my life because this is what I need, this is the people that I checked with, and I think this is a part of my life that I have to give towards making a parnasa. So you go in with the mentality of, I have to make this something that God will be proud of. Now that means that sometimes you may have to make decisions. But there's a lot you can do in the work world to make Hashem proud. A lot. There's a lot, like you said earlier, there's a lot of things. The way you work, working is not wrong. It's how you work that's wrong. It's how much you buy that if you go to this place or that place that you're going to make more money. It's how proud you are to walk around with your Judaism. And when you have all that and you're proud of the work you produce, I don't think it's a bidyevit. I think, if anything, it's a lechatchila. I think a Jew that walks around and says, I need to make a parnasa, I want to have a certain lifestyle, I believe, and during these hours of the day, I am on in my parnasa, and I'm all on, I think you can go in, and again, you have need a rav to take you there with you, with a certain level of, my job is to makadish my life, and part of being makadish my life is the way I work, and it's going to be the best job I do. I don't hand in product that's half done. It's not how I don't build a bridge that's half done. I don't build a hot. And so, but it only works is if you're introspecting. You don't give up. Guys do this all the time. We do this in my class. Those who take my class, you know, I'm all over you with this. Guys feel like they do very little thinking in life. I think I should be an accountant because I heard from my Rebbe in Israel for 5 minutes, who's sitting learning all day, that if you're an accountant, then you can spend time learning. Wow. Is your father paying for your lifestyle? Oh, I didn't realize that being an accountant is... Oh, so now that's why these accounting firms don't hire you guys. And I heard that if you're a lawyer, for 2 years that you're learning these big firms, you make a lot of money. But the truth is, if you can take this practice, that's not what we should be doing. If I'm sitting with my Rebbe and I say, this is what I want to be in life, the hours that I'm giving towards work, I'm dominating work. I'm dominating it. This is where... And if you dominate work and you're proud of your job, you're going to find more time to learn because you're going to be... Your life's going to work. You're going to be a lechatchila. And I think that unless you're introspecting, unless... This is so critical. You need to have a rav that you can connect to that gets it. You have a rav here that gets it. You need people that you can come to and say, what's going on in my life? Because you need somebody else beside you to say, you're doing good. Hashem's with you. Because if you go to your life and your job as a bidi eved, and you feel like every hour you're there is a waste, it's all going to crumble around you. And so I think that's very important. I see this a lot. That we just think that if I'm working, I'm just a bidi eved, and if I'm learning, then I'm a lechatchila. I don't know if that's right. I think that if you're working for right reasons, you're a lechatchila. And if you're really able to do that right, and you have that mentality, and you're checking, and you're growing, you have the space to do your job, you'll have the space to do your learning, you'll be able to walk with Hashem, so to speak. And the more you feel like you're walking with Hashem, there's no job that I know of, there are a few that I know of, but there are no real job that people are going into that are wrong in its absolute form. There are lawyers that are complete animals. There are lawyers that are like statesmen. They're statesmen. They're refined. There are doctors, accountants, real estate guys, mortgage brokers that divide. And some of them are just, they're stars. And you see them. And some of them are not. And I think that when you're going into a job, it's not about the job you're going to, it's what you make of it in terms of how much, as I said to you earlier, it's how much of you do you want to bring in that job. And if you bring in with that perspective, I think you'll feel different. More importantly, you'll have the rest of your life to be different. I see guys all the time that are living bidyevit careers. And because of living bidyevit careers, it drags everywhere with them. They can't learn because they're worried about, should I do this? There's stress in the house. Everyone always feels guilty. There's no happiness. There's no simcha. And I'd see other guys that say, this is my tafkid, this is where I am in my life, maybe one day it'll be different, I gotta get up at 5:30, I gotta learn at 5:30, but this is what I do to work, and then in my off times I'm able to do that, and those people thrive, I think, both in Yiddishkeit and also both in Russian. But it's really your perspective, and I think, I hope you take this, it's not the hours you put in, it's the perspective you put in during those hours. It's a great question.
I would say the same thing, though the only in a slightly different term, but the same thing. I think that in order to respond to Blass's question, if you can frame what you're doing as Avodas Hashem, as Ritzon HaBorei, that's what you're supposed to be doing. See it as, and you have to be able to reframe what you're doing as a Avodas Hashem. If you can't reframe it as a Avodas Hashem, then you shouldn't be there, right? If you're one of these lawyers who is who's doing terrible things, so that's not a Avodas Hashem, then you shouldn't be there, right? At the same time, the way I would look at it, so I would say there's always level number one of Avodas Hashem. To be able to support your family is a noble thing. When a person goes to work from morning to night and the work is boring, he's not interested. But if the attitude is, this is how I support my family, that's a noble thing to do, to support your family. This is how I pay my children's yeshiva tuition. This is how I'm able to have a comfortable home. That means that every moment that you're working, you're doing Avodas Hashem, you're doing Ritzon HaBorei. That's at the most basic level. Then you can often, hopefully most of the time, you can upgrade, right? Your Avodas Hashem can be that people respect from people. That people who are less religious respect from people. You can upgrade your Avodas Hashem depending on what your profession is, right? If a person goes into medicine, it's very easy, right? Because then you're always taking care of people. I have Balabatim who have legal careers, and if they help another guy get a job, that's a tremendous thing. They help a young guy from Yeshiva get a job, right? They're taking care of another family. Right? If they can mentor another person, if they can give a person a job, or get a person who was slightly disabled, get them a job, that's they've done tchias hameisim, pikuach nefesh. And people who run businesses, and they have slots in their business for people who would otherwise not be able to get a job. So that's a tremendous, that's a avodas Hashem. And that's in a business, that's not in a profession. But if you can you can always able to see, and then if you're always looking for opportunities, again, and if a person's a lawyer, you can help out so many institutions in terms of legal advice, help them out, guide people correctly. If a person can't afford a decent lawyer, you take care of them. There's so many ways in which a person can, there's so many opportunities which come your way. So you always have to be able to reframe what you're doing as the Avodas Hashem. And I think if one does that, how does one get to that madrega? So I think that is so much of the work that you have to be doing when you're in yeshiva. When you're in yeshiva, you're building yourselves up, you're creating aspirations for yourself, ambitions for yourself, you're, number one, establishing a certain standard of conduct for yourself. To be a refined person, to be an elegant person. And you're always looking around at other Jews and say, that's an elegant Jew. He's a model for me. He conducts himself in a refined way. He would never say something that is in any way ugly or vulgar, right? So right now, one of the things you're doing is you're looking around and you're looking at people in shul, people that you're governed with, and say, wow, this guy, he's a refined person. Let me use him as a model, right? And you keep on going, doing that through life, and then you also find things that speak to you. You find Rabbanim that speak to you. You find Svarim that speak to you. Right? You find a Sefer that speaks to you, that becomes a life companion. And until you've gone through it so many times that you already know it very well. So you find another Sefer that speaks to you. Right? And by doing that, you keep on finding different sources of Chizuk. And I think it's like a practical Eitzah in terms of the larger issue of being able to frame what you're doing as a Avodas Hashem.
Yeah, the hour is late. I just want two more items. First of all, before the two items, to thank Rabbi Neuberger and Mr. Ari. Very, very nice. They ask nothing in return, other than just the Mechazik guys. The two items I'd like to call Alex just to make an announcement about a new initiative, and then whoever wants to dive Meyer back will
Hi, I'm Alex Forsett. I've spoken to a lot of you in this room, and I think I know most people here. But I want to, you know, especially those of you who are graduating now or are already in the workforce, that we're trying to start an initiative to have a yeshiva program for professionals and full-time graduate students who won't have the privilege of being part of the base medrash full-time anymore, but who are interested in a serious learning program. We're looking at a model starting LL next year around September time to involve someone who's going to be a Magid Shir and someone to set up the program and start someone through Reads, where we'll have a set pace for learning Bikiyas throughout the week on your own time with the Chavrusa. In addition to that, we'll have an Iyun Chavura like twice a week for 45 minutes at night, so, you know, married guys, single guys, everyone can sort of make time for it, hopefully, and we'll start growing the program and building it more, hopefully, as time goes on with a Musar Shmuz and Parsha, and as we have different phases of things we can add as it grows bigger. So to ask everyone who's in this room who's clearly interested in keeping up their standing as a Ben Torah as they proceed out of YU to be like ambassadors for this program. More information will come out in the following weeks and months, but just help spread the word and try and get people on board so we can really start something and redefine, I guess, what it means to be a Ben Torah in the workforce and as you go on to graduate school. You can speak to me or Jonah Rumelstein if you have any other questions or want to contribute or commit. Thanks.
Meyer, if anyone wants Meyer.
It was a pleasure.